This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 1 year ago today, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker took to the podium at the State House. He spoke to reporters in the state, unmasked, standing shoulder to shoulder with his public health team and the American Sign Language interpreter, and he said this.
Today, I'm declaring a state of emergency in Massachusetts. This declaration will give our administration more flexibility to respond to this evolving outbreak. Responding to this evolving health threat requires everyone to be vigilant and for everyone to be part of this effort.
So much has changed since then. At the time, we had inklings, but we didn't know the size of the cliff we were about to go over. Parades, events, gatherings started to get canceled. Businesses were still open. That same day, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said this about preparing for possible additional shutdowns.
I hope it's being blown out of proportion. I hope that I can stand here in 3 weeks and say it was completely blown out of proportion and we did all this preparation for nothing, but I'll be grateful for that. I'll be happy if I have to do that. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, it wasn't the case by a long shot. Infection spread, and by March 15th, we were peering over the edge of that cliff. Governor Baker limited gatherings to 25 people, closed on-site restaurant dining, and shut down schools.
I realize these measures are unprecedented, but we're asking our residents to take a deep breath and understand the rationale behind this guidance. Grocery stores are getting restocked. The reason we're seeing bare shelves on the news and when we shop is because people are taking stocking up a little overboard.
We went overboard, and then we plummeted. Everyone's lives changed. By April 15th, the number of dead topped 1,000 in Massachusetts. And for the governor, emotions were raw.
My best friend lost his mom to COVID. He and his mom had a great relationship. And because they had a great relationship, they never left anything unsaid. That didn't make the fact that it was an extraordinarily painful process for their family to go through this loss of a critical ritual that's this chance to say goodbye.
So now here we are. 1 year later, more than 525,000 Americans, more than 16,000 Massachusetts residents are dead. Businesses, families, educations, all our lives upended. But maybe there's light on the horizon. More and more Bay Staters are getting vaccinated each day, and that leaves us wondering, who is the end of this pandemic in sight? Today on the show, we want to take some time and look back on where we've come this year and where we're headed. Joining us for that, we have three great voices, and I want to bring the first on now. Dr. Ashish Jha, health policy researcher and the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. He is also the former director of the Harvard Global Health Institute and a professor of global health at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Jha, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
It's good to have you back. And I do want to let listeners know in a little bit, we're going to open the phones to you. So if you want to call 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Jha, I knew what we were going to play and I'm feeling it. So let me give you a chance to just react to what you just heard.
Yeah, I had an inkling of what you were going to play. I don't think I expected to emotionally react the way I am right now. It's been a horrible, horrible year for all of us. The entire country, the entire world, and it's been relentless. And I think the good news at this moment is that it is going to end, and it's going to end soon, and life will get better. But we have been through a really painful year, and I think it's really important that we reflect on it, think about things that we could have done better, and resolve to do better for the future.
There's so much I want to ask you more about and what you just said. Let's just start with you talking about reflecting on what we could have done better. And, you know, we've been talking all along about that, but I wonder, looking back a year ago now, March 10th, 2020, and the few days after, at that time, were we getting it as right as we could? Or do you remember thinking even then, wow, there's something else I wish we were doing.
Yeah, I think there were two things happening. I remember the first couple of weeks of March really vividly, February, first week of March. And I remember a disconnect that I felt internally. So there was like the part of my brain, like that could look at the data and look at the facts and know what we were heading towards. And I was saying it publicly, this is a global pandemic. We're about to get crushed. We're not ready. And all those words were coming out and they were all based on kind of data and science. And yet there was this feeling of, we can't possibly be going through this. Like we can't possibly, like I was making the recommendation that we have a national shutdown and thinking, how could I possibly be calling for that? That makes no sense, partly because we had never been through such a thing before. So I think there are two sets of issues that I think are really important. One is, I do think we could have acted earlier. I think Governor Baker could have acted earlier. I think Governor Cuomo could have acted. God knows the President of the United States could have acted earlier. But the part that I'm sympathetic to is that what public health experts were asking them to do was so unprecedented, so out of the realm of anything we had ever done, that I think most people couldn't believe that that's what we were actually right. suggesting. And that led to, I think, delays.
You know, you also said in that first response to what you heard at the top, that you do think there is an end coming. And I can imagine listeners sort of feeling like, I want to believe you about that, but I don't want to get my hopes up if it's not really coming. So what makes you think a year later, after all that pain, that we might really be seeing the glimmer of a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah. Oh, I feel like the light is getting pretty bright. I think we're going to have a wonderful summer. I think the summer is going to be very, very good as long as people get vaccinated. Vaccinations are going well. These vaccines are incredible. The vaccines are the ticket out of the pandemic. Let me be very clear that, it's not like the virus is going to go away. We're going to be dealing with COVID for years. But the way it dominates our lives, the way it affects our ability to see our friends and family and give hugs and spend time with people, that will all change. That domination will go away. That fog that sits on top of all of us every single day will lift, and it will lift in the weeks and months ahead, not years. We'll feel it starting to really disappear by the time this spring is over, and certainly by the summer.
So Dr. Jai said that we were going to bring some other voices in. I want to bring the next one in now, which is WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown joining us to have a chat here. Steve, hi.
Hi there, Tiziana.
So we're all going to stay together. It's sort of like the sitting at the bar and having a beer and reflecting that we can't do in person. We're all going to do it here on air. So as we add you in, Steve, I really want to ask you, you were there. I mean, we played some strong stuff from the governor at the top. You were there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you could feel that tension in the room when the governor would be getting emotional. And you knew that this was heavy-duty stuff. And I remember those first few news conferences in early March, knowing, where are we heading? And as Dr. Jha was saying, he saw the data and everything like that. We were hearing news reports. I remember saying to my wife, I just heard that they've shut down Italy. Can you believe they have shut down Italy? It just seemed incomprehensible at the time. And to think that we would be going through the very same thing within a matter of weeks, I just couldn't wrap my head around it. We were all trying to be continue that normal life as much as we could. As you said, the news conferences, he was standing shoulder to shoulder with his health people, and we were all there, jammed into a press conference room, all seats right next to each other. We never gave it a thought, and wow, where we've gone since then.
I'm going to add our third voice now. WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger joins us. Martha, hi.
Hi, everybody. So fascinating to hear your reflections. I think, like Steve, I had that same feeling of just the jaw kind of constantly hitting the floor as you would hear the news out of Italy. And then, of course, we had New York just hours from us in free fall at one point. And I remember thinking, that can't happen in Boston. Boston is the medical mecca. It's just, we're we could be better than that. And in fact, Boston was better than that, but we didn't pat, you know, we still got slammed so hard. It was just like a fire hose of sensations and information and trying to process everything that was new in real time. And you know, we were just watching this, we reporters. We weren't in the emergency rooms or the ICUs where these things were just taking hold of people's lives and pulling people out of their homes and, you know, disruptions on every level. But, you know, we can, as Dr. Joss says, slowly start to see a way back to something that's different. I don't think it'll be normal, but better than it has been for more than 12 months now.
Let's grab a call, and then we're going to go to a break and come back and sit at the bar some more. We've got Nancy on the line in Framingham. Nancy, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say that your pandemics changed the course of history for decades and even generations into the future, and it's going to be a whole new adjustment of society. Germs don't discriminate. They proliferate. So take guard.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy, for that. We are marking the one-year anniversary of the start of the Commonwealth state of emergency. Last year, if you can believe it, at this time, businesses were still open, students were still in school, white-collar workers still at their desks, although not for long. We are talking with Dr. Ashish Jha, the health policy researcher and the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, and WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger, WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown, as we reflect. And we invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk to share your memories of what this moment meant. So Dr. John, Martha, Steve, early on, one of the challenges we faced here in the Commonwealth was getting access to testing and then PPE. I mean, I think we all remember it, personal protective equipment. I want to play for you a moment from Governor Baker at the end of March after he'd gone back and forth with then President Trump on PPE supplies.
But we've literally gotten to the point where our basic position is until the thing shows up here in the Commonwealth of Mass, it doesn't exist. But I'm telling you, people are spending hours and hours and hours trying to get this stuff here.
That anger seemed so well placed. I have questions for all of you on that. Dr. Jha, starting with you, did anyone ever think in the medical community that we'd be at a point where we couldn't get things like face masks?
No, I think there were two parts of this. I mean, one is these things are generally quite plentiful. So we never thought that we wouldn't be able to have face masks and shields and gowns that, you know, they're ubiquitous in the hospital. The other part was we knew we were supposed to have stockpiles of these things. And we also assumed that if there really was an emergency, the federal government would kick into gear and produce a whole bunch of this stuff and get it from across the world. And so the idea that healthcare workers on the front lines, and we saw pictures of this, would be wearing garbage bags or would be having to do, you know, reuse masks, I think never crossed anybody's mind. We just didn't think it was on the list of possibilities, one of the many ways in which I think the pandemic shocked us out of complacency.
And Martha, as you were reporting on it, so I'm curious, was it like a jigsaw puzzle of understanding, you know, what was missing a little bit at a time, or was the whole picture clear sort of right off the bat?
Oh, it was mud, Tiziana. I mean,
interesting.
You might remember that we didn't even start universal masking in the hospitals until, I don't know, Dr. Jha, was it into April? Forget
yeah.
now.
Yeah, it was late April. Yeah.
You know, so we didn't need the concept that everybody should be wearing a mask was not universal, even within hospitals. So you would have, and frankly, in many hospitals, there was a real hierarchy, like the doctors and nurses got it, but not a lot of the transport folks or the cleaning crews. So that's why you saw higher infection rates in some cases among some of those people. But, you know, I have to say there were some real heartening moments as well. I mean, you saw sisters set up 3D printing companies in their basements to make face masks for hospitals. You saw groups come together virtually to start making gowns so that people didn't have to wear the plastic bags that Dr. Jha was just talking about. You know, healthcare workers making arrangements to send their kids to someplace else so that they would protect them and could come and go more easily. I mean, people went above and beyond on so many levels, even when they really didn't have good information about what they should be doing.
Steve Brown, I'm appreciating that moment of inspiration from Martha there. It's good to be reminded of that. I'm also struck by, it was one of many times in the spring, and you and I covered some of these press conferences together, that we saw Governor Baker get very angry, show a lot of emotion, which is not his typical. Had you seen that before? And as a reporter, I mean, what did it make you think when you saw the governor being that clear about just how frustrated and upset he was?
Yeah, he can get emotional and can get angry, and those were, that was, you know, that initial thing of the PPE problems of supply. Remember back then, the state were competing against each other to try to purchase PPE, and then a bidding war was going on. In many cases, the state thought that they were the high bidder, and then the federal government would swoop in and then take that away, outbid them. He was ticked off, to say the least, about that. And he had an event earlier today in West Bridgewater at Chambord Advanced Materials, which is a company that started making masks. They're making N95 masks here in Massachusetts. And he seemed to be somewhat relieved and optimistic that if we were ever to go through this again, we have people here locally that's making it. So he's hopeful that we never face that kind of thing again.
I'd like to go to the phones here and just to get a couple of caller reflections. Let's just grab Barbara in Oxford. And listeners, to join this conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Barbara's calling from Oxford. Barbara, go ahead.
I just wanted to call and say that I thought something that we didn't really realize was going on during the COVID problem was the people in the assisted living and nursing homes that were being cared for people that weren't prepared to care for people with COVID. And I believe I lost my father, and I believe that a lot of the problem was because they weren't prepared, people were basically left on their own. If they had COVID, doors were shut. Minimal care was given because they didn't think there was anything they really could do for them. And I think that that's a reason we lost a lot of our seniors. And
Barbara, I'm sorry for your loss. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. And I am really sorry for your loss. I'll turn to you there, Martha Biebengerner. Chris, it makes me think of the Holyoke Soldiers Home, as well as all the losses we saw in the spring. What went so wrong, Martha?
Well, I think there was a real lack of information. I mean, if you take the Holyoke Soldiers Home case, for example, just one thing that went wrong there was taking people who had COVID and moving them into units with people who were not sick or who had not been infected. There was, the virus spread very rapidly in those settings and in other congregate care settings because there is so much shared material and people. Staff workers and such go back and forth between the rooms, and there weren't the precautions that we know are so obvious now, the masking, the safe distancing. You know, ventilation was certainly probably an issue there as well. And then, of course, age. You know, these are people who are already predisposed to some serious illnesses, particularly lung ailments. I'm sure Dr. Jacques could add a lot to that. But that setting has been such a tragic piece of that, and I'm very sorry for the loss there as well.
Dr. Jha, I do want to invite you to add on, and especially if there were any states early on that actually really did understand quickly and got congregate care of older adults well, did it well.
Yeah, so adding one bit to why we got things so wrong in the very beginning, I mean, I think one part of it was our lack of understanding of how this virus spread. We way overemphasized droplets, surfaces. If you remember, there was all this talk of, do you have to wipe down your groceries? And this idea that 6 feet was somehow magical. What that meant was that in congregate care settings, we put people in rooms without good ventilation, as Martha said, and not really appreciate that this is aerosolized, this is an airborne disease. An idea that CDC and WHO still struggle with to some extent to this day. And that is really, I think, that the lack of that knowledge really I think was so devastating and made things initially so difficult. There were states that did better overall in terms of managing congregate care settings. Washington State, which actually was one of the first places to suffer, then I think made a series of changes that was very helpful. But ultimately, all of us, I think, really struggled through March and April because there were fundamental parts of this disease and how it spread that we didn't get right.
Well, but we did get that guidance, Dr. Jha, from public health professionals. I mean, the 6 feet, the wiping groceries. And I remember, I almost hate to bring this one up because we know why we got this guidance, but I remember when it was don't wear masks.
Yeah. Look, there's a lot that we got wrong. I think the surface stuff is, I know exactly why we went and did swabs of surfaces and found virus and said, oh my God, virus is on surfaces. You got to wipe things down. You got to wash your hands. Washing hands still important. But, you know, and we had a little bit of a mental model that that's how influenza spreads. And there is a much bigger surface component to influenza. So we thought, well, that makes sense as a respiratory virus too. And at the end of the day, there was not great public health messaging around a lot of these things. And I think it continues to plague us. I still know people who are confused about some of these issues. But the initial missteps were a real problem.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Brenda in Framingham. Brenda, go ahead.
Hi. I was just, you know, listening and reflecting on the year that's gone by. I'm a public school teacher. And a year ago when school was canceled, I hit the sewing machine and was sewing masks for Metro West masks made with love because there weren't enough masks going around. And now fast forward a year, yesterday I went into a classroom. I teach English language learners, and I stopped by the school. I'm getting ready to go back in person and met my second graders for the first time, and they looked so tiny. Just the, you know, because I hadn't met them in person yet. And it's just these two images are just colliding in my brain right now. Like a year ago, I was frantically making masks for hospitals and nurses and nursing homes, and here we are. And it's just, I just wanted to
share. Thanks, Brenda. I'm glad you did. I'm going to get one more. We've got Ann in Burlington. Ann, share your memory too.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me on. A year ago today, I was listening to what was going on with Governor Baker and also in New York City. And I own a business that requires me to go to New York on a regular basis to purchase fabric. So I went down the next day, and I was astounded at the fact that it took me 3.5 hours to drive from Burlington to Midtown, New York. And my hotel room was ready for me at 10:30 in the morning. So I did my business, and the next morning I was walking around Midtown, and it was deserted. There was no one on the streets. There were no cars. At 8:15 in the morning, there were no commuters. And I called up my husband, and I said, this is real. This is not a drill. I'm going to get the fabric, and I'm coming home this morning. And I left, and that was the last time for about 5 months that I was able to do any work down in New York for my business.
Anne, thank you for sharing that memory. I want to turn back to our guests now. And I think building on those memories, I want to start looking forward now. So Steve Brown, I'm going to turn to you, senior State House reporter. We've talked already today a couple times about you covering Governor Baker's press conferences. The tone, the tenor, his popularity, people's reactions to him have changed over time. One of the questions has been, how long will the Commonwealth tolerate being under a state of emergency? And I gather that you asked the governor about that, when he might lift it today.
Yeah, I did ask him because it is the one-year anniversary. He's hopeful that it'll be soon, but he says that there are two unanswered questions that will determine when the emergency orders can be lifted.
I don't know exactly what's going to happen with the variants and what they mean with respect to transmission or vulnerable populations. And the second thing is, I don't know how fast, until I know more about the supply question, we can vaccinate, you know, if we got enough supply to meet the demand we have and the capacity we have. I mean, we could do more than 1 million people a month. Easy. We could probably do 2 million people a month. That would move the ball in a big way to get us to the point where I'd start feeling comfortable that we can start thinking about where we are with respect to the emergency order.
So Steve, we know go ahead. Go.
I guess the answer to the question, though, is when this emergency order can be lifted, no one really knows for sure. People are hopeful, but we don't have that exact answer yet.
And Dr. Jha, you know, you actually struck a hopeful note early on in this conversation, for which I was honestly personally grateful. I hear Governor Baker talk about a million people a month. We are in such short supply of vaccines now, it's hard to get my head around that possibility. But are we close to a time when we're at equilibrium, and if you need a vaccination shot and you want one, you can get one?
Yeah, we're very close. So March will be a month where demand continues to outstrip supply. Sometime in April, maybe the later part of April, it'll start feeling like we're getting to a point where people who want vaccines can get it. And certainly by May, I believe, we'll be in a time period where any adult who wants a vaccine can get one at some point in May, maybe early May, maybe late May, I don't know. But before Memorial Day, anybody who wants a vaccine in the Commonwealth will be able to get one. And I also think it means we're looking for a really good June and a fabulous summer that feels a lot more like the summer of 2019 than it does the summer of 2020.
And do you believe that there is the will among our populace to get us to herd immunity?
I sure hope so. I mean, the benefit of getting vaccinated is amazing. You can see people, you can do things, you can be normal again. It's such a profound, it's so profoundly important. And of course, it's not just for you, right? You protect everybody around you as well. So I do think a vast majority of the citizens, of the people of Commonwealth, will get vaccinated. We're going to have to work on some people who remain concerned, who remain hesitant, who want to know what the long-term issues are, how safe is it. I think we'll have to continue engaging with people to get them there. But I'm pretty confident we will.
So I'm going to turn then in the end here to Martha Biebinger, our healthcare reporter, and ask you, Martha, across this landscape of the last year, have you seen changes to our healthcare system that you think are fundamental, that will outlast this pandemic and just be the new way we do things in healthcare?
Sure. I think wearing masks will become much more common for what might be seasonal coronavirus or even seasonal flu, because we've seen the infection rates for so many other diseases go down because people are wearing masks. The movement to calling your doctor or your nurse practitioner via your phone or hopping on a quick video chat, that's definitely here to stay. And there are lots of other trends that I think are harder to see the crystal ball on, but, you know, hospitals are doing more care at home. I think people are using the healthcare system in a different way, since it's not been quite so easy to stop in at your doctor's office or go to the emergency room. So I think we can't predict all of the changes that are underway, but yes, there will be many lasting, and they are still evolving.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for reflecting with me and with us today. We just heard WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger. Also, we've had WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown. And we started and we'll say goodbye here to Dr. Ashish Jha, the health policy researcher and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's turn our faces to the sky and to the soil. The temperature is in the 40s in Boston, but it hit 61 yesterday, and it might reach the high 60s tomorrow. Is spring finally here? Or maybe I should say, please, oh please, somebody tell me spring is finally here. I know it might just be wishful thinking after a long pandemic winter, but I think we're ready to get outside, and that includes getting into the garden, no matter how big or small your garden may be. For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about gardening, and we're going to take your questions. Are you gardening this spring and summer? Are you planting something somewhere? What is it? And what do you want to know about what to plant, how to plant, where to plant it, how to make it thrive? Maybe you're new, maybe you have a green thumb. Call with your questions. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. To answer said questions, we have WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein, who is also the horticulturalist, not going to say it again, behind the website growingwisdom.com, and Patricia Spence, president and CEO of the Urban Farming Institute. Dave, Patricia, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Dave, I'll turn to you. Is this the best time to get started growing? And if not, how close are we to that moment?
Yeah, it really depends on exactly what you're growing. So I have started things like onions already a couple of weeks ago inside. So, it is going to be cold here this weekend and next week. So it's a little early to be kind of digging in the garden unless you have some cover. So it's pretty easy. A couple of things you can do if you want to push the season a little bit. Take like a little milk jug or something like that. Cut the bottom, invert it. And you can make like a little greenhouse over part of your garden. And you could plant some seeds under there, things like lettuce. You could put in some spinach now. You could try some peas here. I might wait until after Tuesday of the upcoming week, use this weekend to kind of plan things and then get into the garden next week. It's still a little bit early, but it does look like things are thawed out enough that some of those very early things can go into a vegetable garden.
And Dave, just so we know, why after Tuesday?
So we do have some cold air coming in here over the weekend. As you mentioned at the beginning of this, it is going to be very warm here tomorrow, getting into the 60s. I think we're in the 60s again as we head for Friday. We're back into the 40s in the weekend, and we may stay in the 30s with temperatures in the 20s and teens in the morning on Monday of Tuesday of next week. And that's just too cold. Even something like pansies, which you can get at a garden center right now, which adds some color early in the season, you don't want to put them out with that kind of cold because they're just going to get whacked and the blossoms are going to get whacked. So I'd wait a little bit.
So Pat, I'm going to turn to you. I know the Urban Farming Institute is focused on farming. And Dave was just talking about maybe starting your plants inside, maybe a few things outside. Let's say somebody hasn't grown their own food before and they have limited space. What's maybe the first thing to plant that you can have some success with and enjoy tasting in your own home?
Well, again, let me make an interruption first. Dave, I looked at your website and I am going to try to do cauliflower this year. So I just want to say,
awesome.
Haven't tried that before. So for example, for a lot of new folks, some of my friends, et cetera, oftentimes I'll say, you can try the seeds. I mean, I'll be putting seeds in, for example, or you can wait till seedlings are available. So at the Urban Farming Institute, we have already, we've got a brand new greenhouse. We've already planted so many seedlings, and most of them at this point are probably cool weather crops. So I'll cheat a bit. I won't do everything by seeds. I'll just go get those seedlings when they're ready. So what I normally start putting in the ground would be spinach, kale, and usually a couple of different varieties of kale, collard greens, and then I love peas. I absolutely love peas. Now, again, as David said, I will probably do a lot of this towards the end of the month at this point. I'm not in a rush. I don't want to hit a freeze. So usually by the end of the month, that's when my peas go in. But I do have some harvesting. I mean, we've got some beautiful pussy willow trees in the backyard, and March is actually the time that you actually cut those. So I've got some harvesting to do already. And this is the time, if I haven't quite turned that compost heap, which I tend to kind of forget about when it gets cold, it's time to start activating that and working on that composting scenario also.
All right, let's stack up a couple questions here. 800-423-8255. Let's take questions. We'll start with Alex in Roslindale. Alex, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been gardening for a number of years in a couple of raised beds. And this year I wanted to try starting my seeds indoors for the first time. Never done that before. But I'm wondering if I'm too late. And based on where we are right now, what should I be starting indoors?
All right. Thanks for that. And we'll get a second question, then we'll turn to our guest to answer them both. Will in Reading. Will, go ahead.
Hi. I've been gardening in Reading, Massachusetts for a couple of years now, and we are constantly doing battle with the soil in our yard. We're surrounded by these beautiful trees, but they're making everything really dry and hard, and it's really difficult to get anything to grow because the soil is just so hard and dry. I'm wondering what we could do to improve the soil quality in our garden beds.
Okay, great. So let's start. Patricia, I'll ask you to answer Alex's question. Is he too late to plant seeds inside? And if so, what should he be, you know, planting inside? Go ahead.
Well, no, I don't think so at all. And I used to, when I was brand new at all of this, I oftentimes would proverbially stick them in the window and hope the sun would work. So we don't do that anymore. You now get the appropriate lighting and the appropriate space. So you want to get specific lighting. That's worked the best for me. But I will be planting, for example, right now, a lot of my flowers, actually. Oftentimes, I'll actually go and purchase seedlings at local farms to support our farms and our farmers. But oftentimes, I'll start my marigolds and other flowers inside.
And so, thank you, Patricia. And then, Dave, what about the super dry soil that Will is struggling with?
Yeah, so the super dry soil, I mean, one thing you can do is some raised beds. That tends to work really well. I mean, the problem is if you have trees by a vegetable garden, the roots of those trees are always going to try to go into the soil close to the vegetable garden, and they are just going to suck the moisture out. So raised beds are great. Containers are great. If it's a sunny area, try to use big containers. You can get almost anything to grow in containers. And also to dovetail off, Patricia, it's definitely not too late at all. As a matter of fact, I'll start my tomatoes here in about 2 weeks. So tomatoes, peppers can be started in a couple of weeks. So it's actually too early to start some of that stuff, because what will happen is they'll be too big before they're ready to go outside, and they're going to get real leggy. So you don't want to start those yet. But things like onions, collards, kale, spinach can all be started right now inside, and you wait a little bit to move some things out.
So Patricia, I'm going to give you one that – no, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to add to the raised bed. At the Urban Farming Institute, we actually have a raised bed program. We call it building grow boxes, and where we'll build a box on the concrete, we'll build a box in the backyard. And I've got a big backyard, and I have to be honest with you, even though I've got the big backyard, I love growing in boxes. There are less weeds, number one, over the summer. It's so easy to weed and manage and take care of. But you do have to constantly add bio-nutrients, though, to your boxes, particularly after you hit July. You've got to keep feeding that soil. It's all about feeding the soil. So I actually, even though I have the space, I love growing out of the boxes.
So I'm going to stay with you, Patricia. Fragile Foundry tweeted us a question at Radio Boston saying, my habaneros didn't do anything all last summer, but over the winter in a windowsill, they're going wild. What's up with that?
I won't even try to answer that one. I can't do that one. I don't know the answer. Dave,
do you have any thoughts?
I know it if I don't.
Dave, any thoughts on the habaneros in the windowsill?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know when he says they're going wild. Are the plants doing wild, or is he actually getting peppers? I mean, if the plants are doing well, that's not really surprising, because, you know, this time of the year we've had more light. We've been getting light really for 3.5 months. So things tend to start growing a bit. They might have just been pent up from lack of something during the course of the growing season. And then he gave it to them during the course of being inside. So they're just growing a little bit better.
All right, I'm going to go back to the phones, grab a couple more questions that we can stack up. 800-423-8255. Kathy's on the line from Newburyport. Kathy, go ahead.
Thank you. I bought tulip bulbs really in late October and, of course, put them in the shed, and they're still sitting there. Can I plant them tomorrow on a nice warm day and maybe they'll bloom in May?
I hear the hope in your voice, Kathy. Let me grab one other question, and then we'll see if it's false hope or not. Let's grab Brett in Jamaica Plain. Brett, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? So I grew up gardening in the Zone 4, and I would always have great success doing root vegetables like carrots and radishes and such. And here, for some reason, everything I put in the ground just bolts instantly. I try to water it. I try different things. What are some strategies that I can avoid bolting and actually get a proper root vegetable out of it? Thanks.
Okay, so let's take the tulip bulbs question first to Dave Epstein. Is it too late for Kathy to plant them and get flowers this spring?
It depends on how cold it was in the shed. If the bulbs need cold weather, if they were cold, and I suspect they probably were, it's worth a try. Usually when you buy them, they're ready to bloom. You plant them in the ground in the fall, they'll put out some roots. So they might come out a little bit late, but yeah, it's definitely worth a try. I might put them in a container just to see, because if it doesn't work, I wouldn't want them in the ground, because then I'm just going to have to dig them up again.
All right. And Patricia, I'm going to go with Brett's question. And I'm also going to ask you to define some terms for the newbies who might be listening. Brett talked about gardening in Zone 4. So what is that? And what zone are we? And then he said, how does he avoid bolting? So what is bolting and how does he avoid it?
Well, just if I can talk about the bolting first, not so much for me. I mean, I have that happen as well. Number one, when it gets really, really hot in the summer, for example, lettuce, etc. If you do not watch your particularly your lettuce, just the heat, it will just madly start growing. And so, for example, if I look at lettuce, I will be tending to that lettuce all the time during the summer. Things like lettuce, they love cool weather crops. As far as, and the same thing actually has happened to me with the radishes as well. This was a very tough, hot summer for us. A lot of our crops actually bolted due to the heat. We're hoping it's going to be a lot different on the farmer's end this year. There wasn't a lot that we could do, though. Even though we watered and we tended, it was just so hot. So I'm wondering if that might have been a factor for you as well.
And can you explain zones for our newest listeners? I know a lot of flowers, for example, talk about the zones that they're appropriate for and when. So can you explain that?
I actually will have to refer that one to Dave Epstein.
Dave, how about zones? What I know that the country's broken up into some kind of zones.
So we have plant zones across the area. Most of the listening area is zone 6-ish. Boston 7, then you've got 6B as you get just west of the city, 6A further west. And what that means is it's the lowest temperatures that are reached during the course of the winter. So, for example, 6B would be it doesn't get colder than between 0 and minus 10. 6A would be minus 10 to minus 20. That would be out towards Worcester. So when you look at a plant, and these are mostly the cases with perennials, trees, and shrubs, and you look at it, it says this is suitable for zone 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I tend to stick with zone 6 plants around here. Folks listening further south on Cape, you could probably push 6B or even a 7A plant. Certainly, if you're west of 495, you want to stick with 6A or 5B plants as well, just because it gets cold. And the other thing about the bolting, I suspect that that listener coming from zone 4, he probably needs to move up his planting time by about 4 to 6 weeks over what he's used to, and that'll help to slow the bolting down. We're able to start so much earlier here than in a zone 4, which would be up through central Maine, central New Hampshire, central Vermont. And if he's starting at the same time, that's one of the other reasons why it's going to bolt.
That's very helpful. Before I go back to the phones, Patricia, there's another question that I want to ask you. In your farming, I know one of the things that you think about are foods that are culturally appropriate. And I wonder, are there any foods from the various cultures of the markets that you support that were particularly good at growing because of our climate here in Massachusetts, and that you would encourage people to try in their raised box or their window or their backyard?
Well, it all depends on where you come from. I mean, if you look at Mattapan, where we're headquartered, it is a richly diverse part of the city. And if you're looking at folks, for example, my folks come from originally from Jamaica. And so Kalaloo, the base is amaranth. And that is the green that we use when we make a dish. And that grows profusely everywhere, Kalaloo. You could cultivate it, though, in your backyard, and you can use it in all kinds of dishes. So that is something you can certainly grow very easily in this particular climate. Also, if you're from the Cape Verde area, Coosa squash is something that we grow from the farm, if that is your background and the particular crop that you enjoy. Aje dulces, and I might not be pronouncing it correctly, but that is a pepper that's used in sofritos. And so that's another key ingredient. Last year, we had a run on Trinidadian pimento peppers. Once folks found out we had them, we were wiped out. So the beauty of the farming that we do is that we're very much attuned to the types of things that kind of each culture grew up with. And again, for me, it was the Kalaloo plant.
Let's go back to the phones. Maybe one, maybe two more questions. Rosemary's calling from Salem. Rosemary, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was right now we have a small backyard. We just moved into our house and it's currently mud. And we want to plant some sort of, ground cover, but grass is both boring and doesn't offer much for pollinators. So I was wondering if there's some alternative that you might suggest and when would be best to plant it.
Okay. And I'll put another question to pair with Rosemary there. We've got Jeff in Roxbury. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a new homeowner, and so I'm a new lawn owner, and wondering when to weed, when to seed, and when to feed my lawn.
There you go. Weed, seed, and feed. All right. So, Patricia, Dave, does either of you want to answer either of those questions? Jump on in.
Well, we're farmers, so we don't do a lot with lawns. If I had a lawn, what I would say is grow vegetables and put some boxes on there and grow vegetables. Also, regarding
Go.
Okay. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, to that point, what about pollinators? Are there vegetables that you can grow that are good for bees and other pollinators?
Oh, boy. Milkweed and butterfly plants and marigolds. And there are also certain, certain herbs, for example, that you will grow to keep the, you know, bad bugs away. Certain herbs that you'll grow that will bring the good bugs in, like the ladybugs, etc. So it's a whole ecosystem that you can actually develop in your backyard.
So dill is really good for growing. Yeah. Dill's really good for some of the swallowtail butterflies. The caterpillars love it. So dill's a great plant. I usually grow enough of it so that I can have my own and give some to the caterpillars. In terms of the lawn, ajuga is a good short kind of plant that has some flowers that will flower later in the summer. Or later in the spring. So that's a nice ground cover. Liriope is a good ground cover if you're looking for something that's going to give some flower. If you're not going to be walking on it, if you just want something low that's kind of low maintenance and you don't have to mow. I would stay to the question about her new garden. I would stay out of wet soil. If you can hold soil together with your hand and it's sort of shiny, stay away from it. Don't play with it because it's just going to make it much harder when it dries out. Wait till it dries out enough that it still sticks together a little bit, but it has to lose its sheen before you really want to work with soil.
So I don't think we've got the weed, feed, and seed answer on lawn care, but hopefully we can pick that up in a different show. I know we did one of those last spring and got a lot of good calls on that one, too. This has been just such a treat, such a joy, especially, you know, it's a tough time. And to have people give us a chance to grow, to see the beauty and enrich our bodies, it's wonderful to have this advice. We've been speaking with Patricia Spence, president and CEO of the Urban Farming Institute, and WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, who is also the horticulturalist, and I did say it again, behind the website Growing Wisdom. Dave and Patricia, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us and remembering this past year together. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.